Welcome to ASA Central Line, the official podcast series of the American Society of Anesthesiologists, edited by Dr. Adam Stryker.
Hi, I'm Adam Stryker, editor of Central Line. COVID-19 is having a tremendous impact on our specialty and on the country. At my hospital, we are fortunately not seeing the level of patients that others around the country are because we're a pediatric institution and we're in the middle of the country. But that doesn't diminish our concern in any way. I'm following along very closely all of my colleagues who are having to deal with this right now in the epicenters of the United States and around the world. My concern, like everybody else's, is having enough healthcare resources to take care of everyone that needs it. At the pediatric institution, we're trying to conserve as many resources, as much personnel, minimize exposure as much as possible, so we have the ability to take care of not only the kids, but any adults around the community that may need our help, depending on what happens in the next several weeks. We're trying to figure out ways to match our staffing to what's needed. We, along with many others around the country, have stopped doing elective cases. We're doing only what's absolutely necessary. We're also dealing with PPE issues, just like everyone else is around the country, and we're trying to conserve those as much as possible. And we're preparing for potentially a surge of patients, and we're trying to make sure we have the right PPEs at the right time, and this creates issues in planning. How much do you use when? When do you engage that level of protection? When the supplies run out, how do you manage it? I'm seeing people all over the country having to make do with what they have. And as heartening as it is to see people use their ingenuity and their skills to come up with novel solutions, it's sad and it's disheartening to see all my colleagues around the country have to cope with that. We should all have the appropriate personal protective equipment that we need to appropriately take care of these patients and be there for them throughout this pandemic. There are a number of challenges that we're all tackling, and I feel for all my colleagues around the country and the world who are having to deal with this right now in numbers that are really worrisome, but I know they're going to do a great job. I know all my anesthesiology colleagues are going to step up and utilize their skills whenever and wherever they're needed to help all of our colleagues in healthcare take care of whoever is sick and is in need of medical attention. I have no doubt that we will do the same thing here if and when called upon. With that, hopefully this doesn't last too much longer, and hopefully we minimize the amount of people that need healthcare with all the methods that are being undertaken throughout the country to try to minimize exposure for everyone. And while the epidemic is affecting everyone in the field of healthcare, anesthesiologists are facing specific questions and challenges. That's why the ASA brought together a panel of thought leaders to field questions and share their expertise. The ASA's first COVID-19 town hall webinar was recorded on March 19th, 2020. It was hosted in conjunction with the Anesthesia Patient Safety Foundation and moderated by ASA President Mary Dale Peterson. You can find video of the original town hall at asahq.org/COVID-19info, along with additional COVID-19 resources. For this episode of Central Line, we've chosen to share key questions and responses on the topics of critical care, medication, emergency preparedness, and more. Let's listen in as Dr. Joe Sokol, ASA's Chief Health Policy Officer, chooses from over 1,000 submitted questions, starting with the topic of equipment management.
What type of personal protective equipment should anesthesiologists use for patients suspected of COVID-19?
Joe, Brett Aaron, the recommendation right now is that there's community spread and every patient is at risk for having a COVID-19, especially since we're not doing elective surgery. Wearing an N95 mask with a mask in front of it, eye protection, having a cover garment, either a jacket or a gown. We're currently using jackets because our gowns are in short supply. The CDC has some very good logical set of recommendations that as N95 masks supplies decrease, you may need to use them multiple times. Ideally, you would only use them once for an intubation or anything close to the airway. But as you're walking around checking on rooms or other patients, if you're not doing an airway procedure, you can keep the same mask on, especially if you're there in short supply. Look at full barrier precautions for all patients.
Another question. How do you protect an anesthesia machine from a patient who suspect or may have COVID-19 infection? What special precautions can you take?
Hi, this is Jeff Feldman. I can take that one. So the filter mechanisms that we have in place are pretty effective, and we did just post some updated guidelines on the APSF website just a couple of hours ago with the best information we could find. The guidelines talk about the viral filtration efficiency that you want to have, and in a nutshell, mechanical pleated filters are better than electrostatic filters. Placing a high-quality mechanical filter at the end of the expiratory limb will provide probably most, if not all, of the protection that you need for the machine. We are also recommending that you place a filter at the airway, and that will facilitate sampled gas that you can use for gas analysis, and will filter that sampled gas, which, as you know, is then returned sometimes into the anesthesia machine, sometimes to the scavenging system, sometimes to the environment, depending on your situation. And we're trying to get a little bit better recommendations for that gas sampling device. So the bottom line is filters at the airway, and those describe the viral filtration efficiency. And those numbers were picked for two reasons. One is because we believe that they'll be effective, although we don't have any real data to know what happens when a virus goes into the machine and how what's completely protective. But these are good standards. It's one in 10,000 particles that gets through. When you combine that with two filters, it's multiplied. So two filters at 99.99% will admit one in 10 to the eighth particles. One thing I want to emphasize is you don't want to get the machine contaminated. The guidance that we're getting from the anesthesia machine manufacturers, you can find through the APSF website, but Dräger for sure is not guaranteeing that you can clean the machine completely if it does become contaminated. They're recommending a 3 to 4 week quarantine, actually, before you can use it again. So using the filters on an infected patient are very important.
So lots of questions on N95 masks. How long can you use them? How do you clean them? Can you use UV light to actually disinfect them?
So there's no set standard on how to clean a mask because they're not made to do that. But obviously, during this time, there's a lot of creativity. And we have heard from our colleagues in Wuhan what they have done. And none of this is evidence-based. But when you're desperate and you don't have a mask, some people have achieved that. In a teleconference that with people from Wuhan Hospital, I heard that the people, when they were running out of N95 masks and they were reusing it, they were basically using a hairdryer, thinking that the heat may take care of getting rid of the bacteria as one option. And there is actually about 4 reports in the use of UV light. UV light seems to be effective, but it can degrade the mask over time depending on how many times you run it through it. But apparently, that at least in vitro, seems to work. In that sense, but again, it's the number of cycles that you've run through it.
And how do you save the mask? That's another question listed next to it.
Apparently, the best method is you don't want it to collect humidity. So the best way to save it is put it in a paper bag rather than a Ziploc bag. And that's a recommendation.
Another component when you're trying to reuse the mask is to use a surgical mask over the N95 to prevent soiling, to keep it as clean as possible.
Correct.
Is that better than a face shield?
Well, I would guess anything that physically, mechanically covers the N95, whatever gets the trick done, you still want to get your eyes protected. So you might as well get a face mask with a face shield on it and kind of kill two birds with one stone.
Thank you. Next question. Should we treat all patients as COVID positive?
So this is Grant Whitty. I'll answer that. I think that the challenge that we have is certain organizations like the AANA have come out and they've said that you should wear an N95 for all patients. But the reality is with our supplies dwindling in a lot of locations, if you treat every single patient and wear an N95 on for that case, you may not have an N95 when you have a known COVID positive patient in a matter of days to weeks, depending on where you're at. Many of us working in places where supplies are constrained are wearing our normal surgical mask and normal gloves that you'd wear for a case. and just ensuring good hand hygiene and making sure we're not cross-contaminating anesthesia machines by touching it, and being careful not to touch, you know, a lot of stuff, because, you know, as we all know, it's not common to have virus or other colds that you touch other stuff in the OR and contaminate it.
I want to second that. I work in a level one trauma center in Florida. We have to look at the community spread. We have not started yet. We're getting there. But I think it's essential that you look at the community spread. Working in a level one trauma center, the trauma patients continue to come. If I start using N95 on every trauma patient that I intubate on a daily basis, we're going to be running out of masks. So we actually use universal precautions. We use face shield mask, full gown, but we do not use the N95 for those cases. We're trying to reserve it for the patients that that are at risk, or the patients that are suspicious, or the patients that are proven to have COVID-19.
This is Butch Loeb from Committee on Equipment and Facilities, and I would point out that the guidelines that we've worked on for protecting the anesthesia machines are that you use the same filter system for every patient. I think we should recognize, in other words, that you need to protect the anesthesia machine and have, at a minimum, one filter in the breathing circuit between the patient and the expiratory limb of the expiratory port of the breathing system. Because once that machine gets infected, it will potentially continue to infect all subsequent patients for a period of time. One thing to add about the use of filters is patients who have active lung disease and are producing a lot of sputum are going to tend to soil the filters more quickly, and they need to be replaced. And it makes sense in that situation, especially to have sort of double protection of the anesthesia machine.
I would just like to say that I do think that, you know, reusing the N95s is also a potential solution to conserve. And I've seen a lot of questions in the chat box where we can get more. Certainly, we can use the industrial supplies. And I would encourage people to go to the industries if you have any in your region and ask for donations from those industries or purchases. You know, we have a Kiewit Industries. They just sent us 500. So there are other places that I think we can try to secure some N95s while we're waiting on 3M to ramp up their productions.
The CDC does have very extensive documentation about how to use N95 for extended use and for reuse and the types of situations. So there's certainly information on the CDC website. And I did see something from 3M that they, too, are considering what are alternatives to N95. So I think it is reasonable, and hopefully this will be one of the things that we will work on in my committee, is if there are ways to get either home-built solutions or commercial solutions of respiratory protective gear for our people. One person did submit through our committee that they had a home-built solution, and they tested it by doing the standard Sacrin test with that device, and it passed. So I would recommend that before adopting a solution, that you at least do that very minimal amount of testing to make sure that it works as well as an N95 for those droplets.
Joe, if I could add, this is Brett Aaron. The governor of Ohio was on one of the talk shows this afternoon and said in a week to 10 days, their trajectory in Ohio will put them at the same place Italy is. So I think you have to look at what your community spread is. If you look at the CDC documents, they recommend using an N95 mask for all intubations or very close to the airway. I think there's no perfect answer. I think you have to know what's going on in your community and try to know who your patient is. But you really do have to conserve the N95s as best you can. When you try to reprocess them, you have to be very careful that you don't make them ineffective.
A question, how long after a COVID case do you wait before reusing the OR?
Brett Aaron, it depends on what the exchange rate in the room is and the size of the room. There's a chart on the CDC website that tells you how long you would have to wait when you plug in those numbers before you bring in another patient.
I might add that the recommendations are to try to avoid procedures in the operating room because of the positive pressure ventilation, but try to do as many as possible at the bedside.
How do you convert the operating rooms to ICU care? And how good are anesthesia ventilators to taking care of patients who need ventilation?
When it comes to converting operating rooms to ICUs, the fundamental things that we're looking for are the ability to actually have gas supplies, which is something that all the operating rooms that are going to be applicable would immediately have available, and then easy accessibility in terms of a layout that you can easily walk from one room to the other. And so from that perspective, operating rooms are ideal for that. Now, clearly, using operating rooms for ICU's capacity will certainly limit the or cause substantial issues when it comes to sterility later for conversion back to operating room usage. There's some discussion about taking anesthesia ventilators or anesthesia machines and removing them from the operating room, for example, and putting them in the PACU or putting them in another floor of the hospital that would be made available because there's not enough ventilators in general. But of course, that means that there has to be enough floor space to actually accommodate that to make that possible. In either case, the anesthesia care team, you know, that will have to make sure that they are available to manage these sorts of patients and these sorts of ventilators. The second part of the question in terms of whether or not the anesthesia ventilators that we have, the machines that we have, can function as ICU ventilators. And I would say in general, yes, they can. We did attempt to produce a video for this, but in order to share in the webinar, it wasn't really functional for that to that end. But I want everyone to think about the key things that we're looking for when it comes to ventilators. PEEP, which all of our anesthesia ventilators are capable of generating. Most of the Dräger units that are manufactured are able to generate up to 20 centimeters of water pressure PEEP. They all, any Fabius or later ventilator also has pressure volume loops that we're able to utilize, which we've all seen before and can refamiliarize ourselves with. And furthermore, the FiO2 component in terms of what the oxygen concentration is, clearly manipulatable. We do have some patients that require some other modes of ventilation. For example, let's say the critical care team that's working with you ask for something such as APRV or bilevel, which is a relatively newer mode of ventilation. I want you to imagine this, inverse ratio ventilation. You have your inspiratory phase, which is very long, and your expiratory phase is very short. If you can make your IDE ratio, for example, 4.5, 4.6 to 1, that's essentially mimicking what any critical care team would ask for in terms of APRV or bilevel ventilation. And when you do that, the PEEP is set to 3, and we're able to really simulate that. We're working on making a short video that can show everyone how to do this if APRV is needed. But if you're doing AC, SIMV with high PEEP, all those can absolutely be done on an anesthesia machine, and it's very plausible.
I want to add to that for the listeners. Every day, every single day, we take patients who are in the ICU that go into the operating room, and we can provide ventilation. So yes, there would maybe selective cases that our machine, that an ICU ventilator would be better, but for the majority of the cases, the anesthesia machine ventilators could take care of that. But one thing that came up in our discussions is it is clear that they work differently, and they would have to be managed by anesthesia personnel. Because the way we do normally this at the bedside, this is not like in a large ICU that you can leave the patient on the ventilator. So it would require restructuring, and this will have to be supervised by anesthesia personnel.
I'd like to add that people need to be very careful when they use the anesthesia machines to make sure you've got the filters in place so you don't contaminate the machine. The other, I think, getting the anesthesia machines into the ICUs would be the first choice. Second choice would be using our operating rooms. But there have been some concerns brought up that, not all of our operating rooms may necessarily have slave monitors into a central monitoring station and those types of things. It's certainly things that we can work on. And obviously, if you're out of ICU beds, that would be another choice if needed.
One other comment. This does reflect an off-label use of the anesthesia machine, and I agree with the comments that were made previously. Both Dräger and GE in the last 24 hours have released guidance on this off-label use, which is a big change in the way a manufacturer would do things. So they are trying to support us very well. Those guidance documents I haven't quite finished going through, but they're pretty detailed. And so we're hoping to be able to translate some of that information out to people to make it a little bit easier. Hopefully we have a couple of days before we get to this point so that we can work through the details, because it's not trivial to repurpose the machines this way.
And I want to take this moment to thank Jeff and all the hard work he's been doing and really working with a contact with the FDA to really, I mean, have you ever heard of the FDA, you know, working with the anesthesia machines and, you know, professionals to change guidance this quickly. And so we're working with the administration on this to try to figure out how we repurpose our anesthesia machines. I know that people have brought up as well, using even the anesthesia machines or ventilators that are in veterinary practices. I know my niece is a veterinarian and they use very similar machines as what we use. So we are trying to figure out how we can increase the supply of ventilators that I know the federal government is very concerned that we may not have enough.
Just along those lines, I just want to recognize Dr. Alexis Carmer, who's an anesthesiologist who works at the FDA, who has really been pushing this initiative and recognizing the contribution we can make as anesthesiologists. I think she gets a lot of credit for getting this started and pushing it at the federal government.
Well, and then I'm going to put a shout out to Jerome Adams, our Surgeon General, because as we started coming up with these ideas, he fed that to the White House task force as well. That allowed me then to have a discussion with that task force. So I think this is on a fast track.
I will point out, though, there are a lot of considerations that we're still dealing with. The Draeger machines actually conserve compressed gases, but apparently in some countries, compressed oxygen is in low supply. And one of the things that most anesthesia machines do is they use compressed oxygen to drive the ventilator in addition to the patient gases. And so they actually consume a lot of oxygen. GE has already started to think about and offer ways that anesthesia machines can be converted to use compressed air instead.
This is Brett Aaron. We spoke with one of my colleagues actually called up GE and spoke with the tech reps and asked them what the important differences were with using our machines in an ICU setting. They said if you're going to use them in a PACU or outside the OR, make absolutely certain the scavenging gas line is hooked up. Otherwise, you may get up to 10 centimeters of PEEP that may not show up on the your monitors. The other big difference is the usual ventilators have an articulating arm that keeps the tubing up and out of the way of the side rails. We've had one incident a few years ago where a nurse put up a side rail and compressed the ventilation tubing. Of course, the alarms went off and took a few seconds to figure it out, but this may be a good place for our staff and nurse anesthetists and residents to watch over the ventilators, because when the ICU nurses are not familiar with the ventilators, and that's a real recipe for disaster.
I want to make sure we also recognize that when we talk about ICU nurses, it's very foreseeable that our PACU nurses, who are ICU trained, would be engaged to actually provide this particular care given the scope of the potential problem that we're looking at.
So a follow-up question is, I'm in a COVID-19 community spread area and my facility is still doing non-urgent procedures. What can I do to influence decisions within my own hospital?
In short, we're facing a mass casualty situation from medical disease. And when you follow the American College of Surgeons guidelines, they basically are providing this triage, because the idea of elective is not granular enough in order to identify those patients who need surgery in a more timely basis versus not. So, for example, cancer surgery. My recommendation for working with your surgeons in a hospital is to utilize their own guidelines, their own society guidelines, and talk with them about that, and work closely with them to really guide that conversation in terms of what your facility's present resources are as well as what the specific patient's needs are.
Joe, if I might add, I think many states now have put out emergency orders and have also, you know, really worked with the hospital associations and really trying to cut back on non-essential procedures. So that might be another avenue that people could take, is to go to your either your Department of Health or your governor's office to ask for that type of help as well.
Question, I think it's for Dr. Williams from the Committee on Critical Care. And what guidance can you give to anesthesiologists assisting in intensivist roles when the ICU patient census overloads critical care departments?
Well, thank you very much for that question, Joe. There's clearly the expected possibility in multiple institutions around the country that anesthesiology teams will be expected to provide a support role or a leadership role in the critical care management of patients with COVID-19. This will primarily be expected to focus on respiratory support and management. And this is something that would need to be worked out on a local basis. But here are the essential high points of what's going to be important for that. The first thing will be that anesthesiologists are the one group of people in the hospital that know how to operate our anesthesia ventilators. And in the event that we have to provide ventilation with our equipment, we need to be ready as anesthesiologists to provide 24/7 in-house support for that, effectively making either of our sites that we support, the PACU, the OR, or even floors that we're asked to consult on as ICU services where anesthesia care team members are there available to see to those issues. But in addition to that, because critical care spans so many systems beyond just the respiratory system itself, anesthesiologists may be asked to take a broader role in terms of care for the critically ill patient, including but not limited to procedures at the bedside, central lines, arterial lines, ordering of antibiotics, fluids, and making sure that there's appropriate organ function. So there are some materials that the ASA is working to make available for anesthesiologists to address that particular need. Essentially, if you will, a crash course for anesthesiologists that can be used to provide nuts and bolts information for those of us who may be a little bit farther away from our critical care rotations during residency, so that we can actually provide that particular critical care support. I think it's important for all the groups that have the capability of having intensivists in their departments to allow that intensivist division to take some leadership there to provide that guidance to the rest of the department. And all this really could and should be done in collaboration with the existing critical care infrastructure of the various hospitals that we serve.
There's a question about pediatrics. You know, since the young pediatric population oftentimes are asymptomatic and shedding virus, do you treat them as all COVID patients, or what would you answer that? Maybe I'll direct this to Dr. Peterson.
Joe, thank you for that. And that is a concern that I think pediatric anesthesiologists have. This is a weird thing about this virus. The data we have from China, as well as the other countries, are that infants and young children, really below 19, the MMWR report that came out today, I believe, showed that of all the hospitalizations in the U.S. so far, there have been no ICU admissions in anybody under the age of 19. But we do know, and we know this from a lot of the testing that's been done, that even infants can be shedding virus without ever having any symptoms. And so I think, I know I've been following the chat box here, and there are a lot of questions because we're in a really tough spot right now, because I think with the community spread and having asymptomatic people, children included especially, that are shedding virus, you know, we don't know who is actually COVID-19 positive. And so I think that's why the guidance is leaning towards trying to use more full protection for aerosolizing procedures. Now, we believe COVID-19 is actually droplet and not transmitted like measles. However, we also know that in intubations and other types of procedures, there can be sort of these aerosolization of the droplets for a period of time. And that's why, you know, a lot of us feel that anesthesiologists or anybody performing intubations needs to have that extra protection, at least during those procedures. So some hospitals are really trying to provide, you know, that level of protection for their patients. I know in Europe, where they've had also shortages of N95 masks, they're, you know, going with other kinds of techniques where you shroud the patient and try to limit the closeness that you are with the patient, et cetera, with video laryngoscopes. But I think that's the current guidance that we have, Joe.
Okay, thank you very much.
I do practice at CHOP in Philadelphia, and I could add some more details about the pediatric population. We developed our guidance over the last few days, and we started intending to treat every patient as if they were potentially going to transmit the disease to the healthcare worker. And in a long conversation with our epidemiologist, we have decided to tier our patients. So patients without obvious risk factors, and we have a rubric for who those are. We treat with barrier precautions, our usual way, face shields, things like that. And that's based on local epidemiologic advice. Our epidemiologist said that could change if our population changes, but we felt comfortable not using all of our big resources right now for patients who we couldn't view as at risk. The other strength we have is that the hospital can provide 24-hour turnaround on testing of patients. So we have a policy for any patient that gets scheduled for a procedure in the hospital that follows any of the risk factors, they get tested and delayed if at all possible till we have their test results.
Thank you. Another question deals with VV or VA ECMO. What are indications, if ever, and do you employ ECMO in these patients who are sick with COVID-19 on a ventilator? Maybe Dr. Williams will answer that question.
Yes, I'd be happy to. Thank you very much, Dr. Scholzel. VV and VA ECMO are therapies that have been increasingly, yes, and we're talking about COVID-19, we do surmise that there's a substantial amount of mortality that comes resulting from the degree of respiratory failure, ARDS, and hypoxemia. There are really mixed experiences right now across the world in terms of what the role of ECMO actually should be. The general consensus is that once a patient, just given the limited resources, once a patient's got to the point where VV ECMO or VA ECMO would be considered, that likely VV ECMO or VA ECMO should not be offered. And that's multifactorial. The first reason is that we also see when we have severe critical illness with COVID-19 that there are other sorts of issues that come up, coagulopathy, acute myocarditis, and So from some of the experiences that have been shared around the world so far, these are some of the things that lead to the patient's demise. And ECMO takes a substantial amount of resources. So in a normal ICU sort of setting where you have a nurse taking care of two patients, with an ECMO patient, you essentially put that nurse one-to-one, which means you're choosing not to treat other patients. So in the setting of having a therapy that may be temporarily effective but not effective for the entire course of the disease or having to go back and forth onto ECMO. In addition to that, tying up those resources so that you're cutting by half the number of patients that nurse is able to support has led to a substantial amount of ethical disagreement as to the role of ECMO in this particular setting. That being said, for institutions that are choosing to use ECMO, there have been some applications of that. Once again, ECMO, there's only a certain number of ECMO devices and technicians and or nurses that are available. And so many hospitals are limited to single, possibly double digits in terms of the amount of ECMO they can support. In a surge of COVID-19 patients, that would not be a viable option to maximize treatment. So in summary, that's a complicated way of saying that VV ECMO, which is just lung replacement, and VA ECMO, which is both lung and circulatory support, do not have a definitive role in COVID-19, and right now we can't recommend for their use.
We only intubate patients in negative pressure rooms. The operating room is a positive pressure environment. We only intubate them in negative pressure rooms.
This is Jeff Feldman. I can take that one. So at my hospital, we have decided to intubate all at-risk patients, if possible, in the ICU. If not, we have a designated operating room that we've converted to a negative pressure room, and we're specifically using that particular OR for any patients. Fortunately, we haven't had any yet, and hopefully it stays that way. But we're going to approach it in that fashion where they get intubated in either in the ICU or in a negative pressure room in the operating room.
If I could tag onto that a little bit, the negative pressure room utilization is certainly something that is of great interest for obvious reasons. But there is not a consistent availability of negative pressure rooms in general. Usually a small fraction of rooms in a hospital, i.e. 5%, actually have negative pressure capability. And the normal sort of either positive pressure or negative pressure room functionality means that you have at least 12 air exchanges being positive or negative 2 pascals in order to facilitate that particular sort of air exchange, negative pressure being the negative and positive pressure being the positive. Most new construction now has been frowning on the utilization or construction of negative pressure rooms because the thought is you have a patient that's ill, and you, if you have a negative pressure room, you're drawing all the content from the exterior portion of the room into the room in order to protect everyone outside the room, but you're exposing the patient effectively to more. So this is questionable, and that's why many ORs don't have negative pressure functionality anymore. So the perspective that to avoid intubating less as negative pressure room doesn't become viable in this situation where there's a surge of COVID patients, and preparation should be made to be able to intubate patients with full PPE when necessary as a positive COVID patient in order to allow those intubations to take place.
Thank you. Now, another question. So the patient who's in respirator stress, can you use CPAP or BiPAP, or just go immediately to intubating the patient with known COVID-19?
I'd be happy to take this one because the concern is that transmission of COVID-19 is currently expected to be via droplet. When we apply positive pressure via a BiPAP mask or a CPAP mask or via high flow nasal cannula, the concern is that we're actually helping form droplets, helping distribute COVID further, and therefore increasing likelihood of healthcare workers, physicians, nurses, et cetera, being infected with COVID. Therefore, the approach that we are strongly recommending in general is that once a COVID patient exhibits respiratory stress to where we're seriously thinking about intubation, don't use the temporizing modalities as described. Go ahead and intubate as soon as possible. Furthermore, there is some discussion in the critical care world, and it's not firmed up in the literature yet, but there's some discussion in the critical care world that COVID patients can have very quick respiratory deterioration. So once intubation is being considered or positive pressure support is being considered, there may not be much time left in the first place. And so we want to avoid those modalities and intubate as soon as possible.
Thank you. So another question. I am pregnant and concerned about my exposure to COVID-19. What precautions should I take to ensure that I don't get sick?
So there's a very small series out of, I think it's Italy, 9 women in their last trimester who had COVID-19 and all delivered normal babies and had normal labors. Very small series, but it's of some comfort. We don't know about the effects of COVID-19 earlier in pregnancy. There's no evidence that we can bring to bear to suggest what will happen with the pregnancies. There's no reason to believe that it would be like Zika. If you're working, take the routine precautions, minimize the number of people at the head of the bed, wear N95 masks, wear a mask over that mask to prevent larger particles of mucus or saliva from getting on the N95 mask. Wear face shields, take the usual precautions, use double gloves, try not to contaminate the workspace with what we call bioburden. I think most people will eventually be exposed to disease at some point in time. We're trying to flatten the curve. I think in the 1918 pandemic worldwide, there's only about 45% of the people worldwide actually got the disease. So I think if people follow the instructions, shelter in place, try to avoid hospitals if you don't have to work here, I think that should help protect everyone.
And Brett, do you think that recommendation be the same for a caregiver that's maybe immunocompromised on steroids or is elderly? Or would that be any different?
I think the elderly are at particular risk. We're using telemedicine to stay in contact with our elderly and trying to keep them away from the hospitals. I think one of the biggest arguments against elective surgery is you don't want to bring healthy people around a lot of people who may be shedding virus that's airborne. And creating a bigger problem. I'm not sure we have enough information to the extent that immunocompromised people are more susceptible or have worse outcomes at this point in time. Certainly age is a factor. In the Chinese population, there's a difference between men and women. The men had a much higher rate of smoking. That would appear to be a risk factor compared to the women over there.
Thank you. The next question is, should we avoid superglottic airways for the time being? I was told today that in China, they decided a closed system with a tracheal tube was best to avoid aerosolization.
This is Albert Varin. What I hear actually is that they recommend that in case you have a failure of intubation, not as a primary method. But since you have very restrictive options when you are intubating this patient, you may only have an assistant and you may not be able to do a surgical airway. That would be the plan B, is to insert an LMA if it's a difficult intubation and you're unable to secure the airway. But I have not heard that to be as a primary airway and as a first choice.
I have something to add. The other place where the LMA is very useful is if you need to ventilate the patient without an endotracheal tube in place, instead of mask ventilating the patient, it is better to put in an LMA. But yes, it is not a replacement for a tube.
Thank you. Another question deals with upper EGDs are considered a high-risk case. Should all non-emergent cases be deferred? And if you end up doing the cases, should all EGDs be done as a general anesthetic with an endotracheal tube?
We have a level one trauma center. We have a city where drinking is considered an art form down in New Orleans. And we have a number of patients who come in who have upper GI bleedings and they need a diagnostic and possibly a therapeutic procedure. We're treating them as with an endotracheal tube, and I think they should be treated like everybody else who's getting an endotracheal tube. We have a very high community spread, so we are intubating everyone, and everyone's wearing an N95 mask, and they're using them on more than one patient. Everyone's wearing a second mask over the N95 to help to preserve its function.
Question about ECTs. Should we be doing ECTs? And if we do them, should we do them all with endotracheal tubes?
This is Brett Aaron. Our governor has issued a mandatory order saying that if a procedure can be done in 30 days, it should be put off for 30 days. ECTs are not an emergency procedure. They're important, but I think we have to really look at the risk-benefit, and not sure that the benefit is there compared to the risk to our employees. Welcome comments from others.
I was talking to one of our psychologists. I was actually doing ECTs, and he pointed out also that usually you need at least three of them sequentially to have any benefit. So that has to be brought to bear. One of the risk factors, though, is people who are either acutely suicidal or catatonic may be in a situation where it really is a life-saving procedure. And so it's like all discussions, it does need to be determined somewhat on a case-by-case basis.
Another question. Is there thoughts of having an innovating team on Q3 or Q4 to limit whole department exposure to potential COVID patients?
We are actually doing that at our institution. We're putting a team together for intubations. And the thinking behind it was basically that if you look at the process for doning and doffing, it's really not that easy, and it takes a lot of practice. And if you have a team that is doing it continuously, they will be in better shape and less chance for mistakes. Actually, in the Wuhan epidemic, there's a video there on YouTube, nicely shows that there was basically a team specific for intubations. I was surprised that now in our department, actually, a lot of people volunteered to be part of that team. And yes, they will be on for 24 hours and then off for 48 hours, and that will be their only function. The only concern, the only downside is that if we start increasing the number of patients, that may not be possible. It's really going to depend on the number of patients that are coming into your hospital. But that's certainly an opportunity, and that will also resolve the issue that if an anesthesiologist is concerned about pregnancy, they could choose not to be part of the not part of the team. But not all practices have enough anesthesiology to do something like this, but if we are able to do that, I think that would be a good approach.
The next question is, once a healthcare provider is placed on self-quarantine after having revealed positive for COVID-19, when can she go back to work?
There is CDC guidance on this. I would recommend that people read it You know, I think it's when they're symptom-free and they've had two negative tests 24 hours apart, is my understanding. And it's variable how long it takes for people to be in that condition. But I would check the CDC website. It's pretty specific.
Thank you. The next question is, can the ASA comment on the support of our trainees in their roles during this pandemic? Our institution has transitioned to an all out of or innovations being performed by an attending physician to create a best first attempt to secure the airways. Residents have commented on concerns regarding contributing to duplication, PPE use, and potential exposure. So does anyone comment about the resident training during this crisis?
Our recommendations are that the most experienced persons in the hospital be the ones doing intubations. That doesn't mean that we're going to replace all the critical care medicine or ER doctors, that will supplement them and obviously be called for difficult intubations. I think a lot of institutions are not, and we don't recommend using this as a training exercise. I think it's up to each institution to consider, but I know a lot are not having residents on those teams.
If I could also comment, the ACGME has recently issued some guidance indicating the committee's understanding that residents' level of case volumes and their exposure to certain types of patients would be limited during this particular event. So the ACGME understands about the concerns and what Dr. Peterson just mentioned, and so we can implement these changes without affecting a resident's ability to practice or their ability to meet their intubation or case requirements for graduation.
I would argue also that this is an unprecedented learning opportunity for our residents, aside from the technical skills that they have to master to become anesthesiologists.
That would be each institution that needs to make that decision and maybe at what level their residents are at to come up with a solution.
Dr. Peterson, I want to say that our CA3s are 3 months from graduation, and they probably in the last 6 months have done many more intubations than some of our faculty. So I believe that a senior level resident or a fellow may be in, at one point equal to an attending at this point. And I also believe it's a good opportunity. We also have to recognize that some of the circumstances, it's not going to be one anesthesia person going in there for the doning, doffing, everything that needs. You need somebody to help you. And if there's not an ICU nurse or a respiratory therapist or somebody else, you may have to have a senior resident with you to do so. So I agree that most of this intubation should probably be done by attendings, but depending on the institution, I think senior level residents or fellows can also do that.
And we don't distinguish in our guidance between attendings and residents. What we say is experienced. And so to your point, you know, many senior residents have gotten a lot of intubation experience.
Thank you, Dr. Peterson. So the SSDM has released an online course for non-ICU trained physicians who will have to care for critically ill patients. Does the ASA APSF endorse this curriculum, or are there additional alternative recommendations?
So I'll take this one. I can definitely speak to the content, and having actually looked over the content that the SCCM, the Society of Critical Care Medicine, is providing, it's a very good practical overview that shows a lot of fundamental concepts and displays those in an effective fashion. It's basically a series of webinars and checklists, but they're very, very helpful. In full disclosure, I am also a member of the Society of Critical Care Medicine, and so the Society has worked to make those materials available without requiring membership to anyone else at this time. In terms of a comprehensive sort of source for information, that's the best that we really can offer in mass right now. We are working to make some more succinct materials available, including but not limited to specific guides that have been for resident rotations in the ICU, which are smooth reads and readily available, and also in association with other critical care organizations, including but not limited to the American College of Chest Physicians and other subspecialty critical care societies. So that being said, I am not, and I'll have to leave it to our president and CEO to determine whether the ASA has officially endorsed it. Our committee is discussing these materials, and we have shared that recently with each other to determine whether or not we should recommend that endorsement. But in general, they are available. I've used them to look at them, see if they're suitable, and they are for the general anesthesiologist.
We have some medication questions. I don't know if anyone can answer this. but several questions about prophylactic Plaquenil. Is there any use of taking that when you start taking care of patients that you suspect may have COVID-19?
All right, so I'll take this one. The prophylactic Plaquenil, or the concept of using or having a treatment in place, Plaquenil is an antiviral that's been around for some time. Hydroxychloroquinolone, that sort of drug has been, and it's currently being studied for efficacy. You might have heard it mentioned recently in the president's press conference about whether or not that's something that could be useful to treat these patients. But right now, there's not an FDA indication for that purpose. We don't have prospective data to recommend its utilization. Of course, if someone's doing very poorly, then that is something that many physicians are considering using. In addition to the prophylactic part, if we have a patient that we're suspecting of COVID and starting Plaquenil or any other drug, that is not something that we can recommend based on the literature at this time. We simply don't have enough prospective studies. However, of course, any member can go online and find a lot of random sources and case reports of various applications of drugs. We do not have a basis to recommend prophylactic Plaquenil at this time.
Thank you. Another medication question. Is it true that NSAID, ACE inhibitors, ibuprofen, and other medications may exacerbate COVID-19 patient symptoms?
If it's okay, I'll take this one as well. The NSAID question is certainly very potent. There was an article written in The Lancet, it wasn't even an article, it was a letter to the editor, which discussed various experiences with COVID-19 patients. We do not have any basis to suggest that ibuprofen or any other NSAID is unsafe to administer to COVID-19 patients. So there's no mechanism to explain that that's actually viable, and there's no prospective study to actually indicate that. The WHO also has removed any suggestion that we should not be using NSAIDs in these patients. Acetaminophen is certainly available, and it's a reasonable choice if there's any sort of lingering concern about acute renal injury or acute renal insufficiency in these patients. They may be critically ill, and that may make someone hesitate to administer NSAIDs in the first place. But there's not a basis just on the fact that someone may have COVID-19 to not administer ibuprofen in the literature at this time.
This is Albert Rivera, and I want to make a point that the health ministry in France recommended not to take ibuprofen, but I agree. There's no basis not to take it. This was just a theoretical paper in Lancet.
So questions, where can I find treatment options for my critically ill patient who has COVID-19?
Well, I'm happy to take that one. In terms of treatment options are really not well established at this point. We don't have definitive known treatment therapies. The actual treatment that we endorse at this time is supportive care, the things that we know that work. For example, proning patients with ARDS has been demonstrated in prospective randomized control trials to actually reduce mortality by approximately 30%. We should be doing that. We should make sure that we are maintaining early goal-directed therapy. These are the classic things that we know work and that are part of what an anesthesiologist training is. In terms of a specific drug or a specific magic bullet, there really isn't one. We've already talked about the Plaquenil or hydroxychloroquine question. There is also a new trial that's being done with remdesivir, which is being conducted at the University of Nebraska Medical Center, which is intended to be a prospective trial that lasts potentially several years, so to test that for treatment of COVID-19, as well as many other sorts of therapies. So none of those have actually been shown to work in the literature. None of these men have undergone the rigor that all the other therapies have undergone. So right now, we have to stick to the basics, stick to what works, preventing ventilator-induced lung injury, making sure we have early goal-directed therapy, excellent supportive care, and attentive medicine.
The American Society of Anesthesiologists published yesterday a special issue, which is available online, and basically review all the aspects of the perioperative care of the patients with COVID-19. And I encourage you to review it.
Thank you, Dr. Varin. The next question is, I'm concerned my practice is financial well-being. How do I pay CRNAs when facilities are closed, operating at less than normal capacity? Is the ASA advocating for us?
Absolutely. The ASA is working to secure support for anesthesiologists in their practices. There are some provisions right now that are under consideration to provide financial support to small businesses. I think it's a possibility some anesthesiology practices would qualify for those benefits. But also, we've joined shoulder to shoulder with other medical specialty organizations asking Congress to do more. We're very aware of the implications for practices, especially with the elective surgeries being canceled, the financial implications for anesthesiologists and their practices. So we do expect a couple more rounds of relief legislation to go through Congress in addition to administrative activities, regulatory activities. And one of our priorities from day one has been to work to provide economic support for anesthesiologist practices. So it's an ongoing effort, and we'll continue to do it until we're satisfied.
Joe, if I can add, our nurse anesthetists are being kept on salary by the hospital and medical centers. They are planned to be used as ICU nurses to fill in as if we hit a surge. I would suggest people negotiate with their hospitals if they employ their own CRNAs, that the hospitals either find a way to employ them as their own employees get sick, or rent them out to the hospital and have the hospital cover their salaries while they're providing care. We have an incredibly creative group of anesthesiologists around the country, and one size doesn't fit all, but I think there's a lot of opportunities to help take care of patients in our hospitals.
This is Adam Stryker, and we hope this episode has given you some information that will be useful as we face the challenges of COVID-19 together. Things are changing quickly, and we'll continue to keep you informed here on Centraline, so join us again soon.
Visit asahq.org/COVID-19info for all the up-to-the-minute resources from ASA.